We're about to committee. We'll come back to order. I have a standing rule with the committee on night hearings, and I promised them all that we would be out of here no matter what happens at 10 o'clock. It's a very, very tough issue, and it's obvious that we're not going to resolve it tonight because, as I've told you before, the looking around on the committee, I don't think that there's two votes on any position to do anything yet. Now, I'm not going to take that motion to table 1050, Representative Lisa. Wait, Carl.
That
was just an attempt to wake you up, Carl. Go ahead, Dave.
In an attempt to answer your question, Representative Rogers, what I'm trying to say is that if the referee awards a claimant a permanent total award and it is appealed by the employer to the Workman's Compensation Board, the employer is thinking, trying to evaluate what his chances are in getting that reversed versus what costs he has to go through insofar as their attorneys are concerned. He feels, if that employer feels, that insurance company feels, that they have a fairly good chance, they'll appeal it to the compensation board. And as I said, frankly, their results have been pretty good, and they removed the total.
Dave, let me throw in something here. According to this chart, it says that the board increased the hearings officer 5.2% of the cases and decreased it 6.3%.
That's on permanent partial awards.
No, this is on all. This
I don't have
all. And that's 0.9% difference. And you're saying that the employers only bet on the fact that the board leans toward the employer?
Well, let's put it this way. They got a better shake there than they do in the circuit court. That's my point.
That's
my point, is that they have a better chance of getting that referee's decision reduced at the board level than they do at the circuit court level, and that is why they're appealed to the board.
That's just not what these statistics say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. See if I can figure this thing out.
Look at that second bar that it says 80.7% of the time they affirm the hearing officer. And we go up to the next point, 5.2% of the time they increase the award. And the next block says 6.3% of the time they decrease the award.
That's on all issues, as you see down below that, though, you see. That is not
sure.
A permanent total.
Sure, that's
well, that's a big
that's
distinction.
All
that's a big distinction. I'm talking about permanent totals. You can talk about rejects. You can talk about penalty questions. You can talk about time loss questions. Those are different. And as Mr. Kennedy was saying, this is a very specialized field. And there are certain feelings about certain issues. And there isn't any question in my mind that I could have 15 defense attorneys tell you that they will appeal a permanent total case to the board every time without any question because they have a pretty good chance of getting it reduced. If you took the board out and had to go to circuit court, they would think twice about even appealing. Now, that's a fact. Any question about that?
Where's all your data to substantiate that?
I don't have all the data. But as you can see from the figures that Mr. Kulongowski read on the permanent totals, how many totals were taken away reinstated by the circuit court?
Dave, you know, I hear this very quickly. It almost looks like the same number that the Court of Appeals took away from the circuit court.
That's very possible.
It is. It's
that's very possible. And there has been a very, very big change in the Court of Appeals in their thinking. There was no question about that. And that reflected in that stat.
Well, I've got two questions. If you've got a copy of the bill there, if you look on page 7, I'm going to just very briefly, these always bother me when I go through these things. At the bottom of the page, 33, lines 33, 34, and 35 on page 7 and lines 1 and 2. where it says, however, if the doctor or vocational counselor believes furnishing any medical or vocational information will be detrimental to a workman, such information need not be furnished to him, but shall, upon request, be furnished to his attorney or other representative. My own feeling is that statement is unconstitutional on the grounds that if a claimant can be his own attorney, I don't know how in the world you can ever deny him the evidence.
I think you're probably right. That's been in existence, I imagine, for a while, and as far as I know, it's never been tested.
Okay.
But, of course, I would know because I'm an attorney and I get the medical, so I know the guy that does it.
Okay.
But you very well may be right.
Okay. You can mark that. The second point that I want to make, and this is just, I want you to know that it hasn't been resolved yet in the bill. On page 14, section 14, lines 12 through 24. That statute had to do with attorney fees at the circuit court level. Now, the way 1050 is written, it eliminates the circuit court, and the court it talks about in awarding attorney fees is the Court of Appeals determining that factual dispute. And it would appear to me that if the bill is Angle Senate Bill 1050 is, it would seem to me that the board should be the one to determine that attorney fee question rather than the court, because the court that they were talking about was a circuit court, and if that's eliminated, I just don't see what the Court of Appeals is doing in that process, getting involved in that attorney fee arrangement. Would you agree with that?
I think I would agree that the Court of Appeals shouldn't be involved in attorney fee disputes, yes.
Okay.
I'm not convinced that the board should be either.
No, I know that. I just want to get in there. Okay, Dave, I'm going to put...
Thank you.
It's 9:55, and I think the committee is well aware of the problems and the different issues with 1050. I want to say that I want to give Mr. Green and Mr. Frederick and all the other employer representatives the opportunity to testify again if they want to on 1050 and some of the statements that were said. It's just me again personally. I happen to believe that the issue with the elimination of the board or the circuit court is a policy decision, and there isn't that much fiscal impact in it. And I really don't believe that anyone has really argued that. You've heard the one side of why they believe it should stay, why it should stay in the system. It's a checks and balance. And I would just ask that the employers and anyone else that testifies in opposition to their position address that issue and rebut that statement, because I understand Mr. Kreiger's position on that, and I think it does have merit to it. The next thing, I'm not going to get to 1048 tonight. The next thing that I would like to tell you is that there has been a caucus called by the Democrats, certain Democrats, at 8 o'clock in the morning. Four of the Democrats that are called a caucus are sitting right here in this committee. We, I would hope, would be done by 8:30 or 8:45, and I'll make every effort to do that. I do not intend to start the meeting at 8 o'clock because there's only going to be three people here.
Session starts at 10.
I know.
We could probably make quite a few decisions.
We could serve as a very good subcommittee.
It could be a subcommittee.
I'm going to tell you, Representative Rogers, though you trust me as explicitly as you do and you leave to leave the four of us here, I can assure you I would never do the same for you.
That's because there are four of you anyway.
So
he couldn't send anything out.
I would say this, that the hearing will probably start, I will make every effort to have it start by 8:30 or somewhere in there, because I do want to get to some of the bills that we have on that agenda. There's just nothing that we can do about it, because I have to be there.
Which side of the bar you're representing?
Is there anything else to come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could hold up 2237 just to take a look at these amendments. Mr. Kalinowski was talking about earlier on that, and we made a judgment not to do that, but he has some language now, just roughly drafted.
Okay, that'd be fine. Why don't you give that to the clerk and have the council, the committee look at that, and if you want to, you can bring it back before the committee at that time. Hearing nothing else to come before the committee?
Friday, June 10th, 8 a.m., Room C, public hearing and work session.
Where have you? Anyone will come to order, the clerk will note those present. All others are excused. The first bill up, Senate Bill 474. The people, I'd like to bring up are those people who are from out of town and cannot be back. I see Wyatt Tolleson. Hyman, are you all from Salem? I know Bill is. Mr. Tolleson and Mr. Hyman, are you both from Salem here?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Caroline Miller testified last week. Irene Sears? Why don't you come on up, Irene?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Irene Sears, and I have been a state employee at Oregon State University for 7 years. I took a day of vacation to attend this hearing because of my concern over the possibility of linking the fair share question with the pay package. These two questions are totally unrelated, and the only reason for linking them is to give an unfair advantage to the fair share question. I personally have no objection to paying a portion of the OSEA dues if such dues, in fact, benefit me. But I strongly object to being forced to pay money to a group who are not monitored by anyone. If fair share becomes part of the contract, I urge that a certified audit be performed every 3 years and the results be made known to the membership. After all, is it that unreasonable to expect an accounting of where your money is being spent? If the executive secretary receives $38,000 a year plus perquisites, shouldn't the membership be aware of this? What I am asking of the legislators is that they consider the far-reaching effects of placing that much money in the hands of a few essentially unmonitored people. At the very least, there should be an escape clause whereby these officers could be made answerable to the membership. And one final point. When votes are taken on collective bargaining questions, I am convinced that for the protection of everyone, the counting of votes should be monitored by a team of disinterested parties. And this should be a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Irene. Any questions, Bill? Ms. Sears, could you come back?
This problem is more for you because I'm not familiar with it. An organization such as the OEA or any other union or lots of other organizations qualify as a nonprofit organization, do they not?
Yes.
Under the IRS. Do they require any kind of a periodic certified audit to retain that that
no.
particular
in the position. Private sector, in 1959, Congress passed what was known as Landrum-Griffin, which became better known as the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. Those labor organizations that are covered under the National Labor Relations Act every year must file a reporting and disclosure report with the U.S. Department of Labor, which sets out expenditures and things of this nature. Those labor organizations that are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act do not have that requirement. There is no such disclosure requirement here in the state of Oregon for public sector unions.
But there could be, could there not?
No, yeah, that's correct. I mean, there could be a law passed to do that. But there is no such law here. And in answer specifically to your question, to my knowledge, there is no requirement of the IRS that these people annually prepare an audit which would justify their non-exempt tax status. I might tell you that there was a case back in, if I'm not mistaken, it's Maryland right now, in which they're litigating the issue whether a labor organization is entitled to a tax-exempt status under the current law.
Is that in a federal court or a
state
court?
It's in a federal court.
Okay.
And there are a number of bills in Congress to take away the tax exemption for labor organizations this time. He was talking to me, but...
Oh.
Is that a rider on the Collins-Fitus bill?
No, it's the collective bargaining bill for public employees nationally. Roberta Barnhouse? Why don't you come on up, please? You were here last week, and I know that...
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Robert Barnhouse, and I work at Oregon State University. I've been a state employee for 10 years and a member of OSCA for as many. I'm also a past member of the Board of Directors of OSCA. I'd like to tell you that I am in favor of the general concept of fair share, but I am here to reason with you for a fair vote on the matter. In speaking against Senate Bill 474, I believe I expressed the view shared by many hundreds of hardworking state employees. As now written, Senate Bill 474 effectively guarantees union control of employees, not an employee-controlled union. A vote on fair share can only be unbiased, well-informed vote representative of the membership if it is separated from the salary package. I recognize that with a membership of approximately 15,000 out of approximately 30,000 eligible employees, union representatives could consider scales tipped against fair share if the bill had a requirement that the fair share agreement reflect an opinion of the majority of employees in the bargaining unit. I appreciate the intent of the bill that it might be to equalize these odds. But whatever the intent, the bill is now written, says clearly to public employees, you must choose the lesser of the evils. If the salary package looks good, you have the right to accept it, but only if you let fair share ride in on its coattails. If you are opposed to fair share, you have a right to reject that, but only if you reject the entire salary proposal, no matter how good it looks. Many of the employees feel that with the right to withhold or withdraw financial support from the exclusive representative is the only one lever they have to make sure the unions keep working for the employees. They should be given a chance to retain that right without being sidetracked by dollar signs on a salary proposal. One of the most often related stories in OSCA recruitment is that of a hitchhiker who gets in your car while you pay for the gas. It is cited as symbolic of the non-dues-paying member. What they're forgetting is the possibility that the hitchhiker can rob the driver, take the car, and leave him stranded. In other words, highly unlikely though it may be, enough votes against fair share, unless it is a separate issue, can put negotiations right back to the drawing board. And at this late date, I don't think that's what any of us want. In requiring that validation of a fair share agreement be contingent upon ratification of the entire collective bargaining agreement by a majority of the eligible public employees voting on the question, Senate Bill 474 comprises the rights of state employees by giving them an all-or-nothing choice. I urge that you give very careful consideration to blocking this bill and affording state employees free choice in which they are entitled, a free choice on fair share by a separate ratification on the collective bargaining agreement.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Mr. Barnhouse? Thank you, Roberta. Before I go on, there are a number of people here on a number of bills, and the set floor session is going to start at 10 o'clock this morning. It does not appear that I will be beginning to Senate Bill 872. Mr. Fleischer, Mr. Fredericks, Mr. Randall, and Ms. McNeil are signed up on that bill. I apologize to you for not getting to that. We will not hear that today. Senate Bill 311, Mr. Wolf from the Bureau of Labor is here. We will not get to that bill. Senate Bill, House Bill 2136, Mr. Martin, we will not be getting to that this morning. Senate Bill 955. Is it Jack Meager? Meager, Mr. Meager, Mr. Honey, and Mr. Mitchum have signed up on that bill, and I will not get to that. The reason I have selectively in this intelligent process that I go through is all of you are all generally here all the time. So I can just set that again, and it's my intent to have those reset on the agenda Monday. Yes, all of them. And generally those people are with the, either with the lobby or with the state association, I mean with the state government, and you can be here much easier than these other people. Is my... Are you with the... Oh, I see. You're not with the state then. Okay. Mr. Meager, I will make every attempt to accommodate you this morning to have you present your testimony on that bill. The two bills that I do intend to have a hearing on, for those people who cannot come here from within the Salem area, are Senate Bill 474 and Senate Bill 727. Mr. Lee Springer on Senate Bill 474.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try not to take too much time this morning. You have all heard the testimony of Winnie Francis last Monday when she appeared here. You have heard the testimony of Ms. Roberta Barnhouse. I won't go back over all of that and say the same thing. I will make a couple quick statements. I believe the majority of state employees do not wish to have the votes tied together. I believe that they are in favor of a separate vote on fair share. They do not want to be in a position of jeopardizing a potential strike situation because they have to vote down a central contract that otherwise may be a contract that they would in fact ratify. They also feel that it could go one way or the other, and they do not feel that they are in favor of a strike. I put together a proposed amendment to that bill, and I would appreciate the committee's indulgence, and I will pass this out.
Why don't you just hand it to the clerk?
Would you like that I read that proposed amendment? The proposed amendment on page 3 of the printed bill would delete all of the new material and would insert the following. Validation of such an agreement shall be by pardon me, shall be independent of any collective bargaining contract.
Thank you.
And shall be contingent upon ratification by secret ballot in each of the appropriate bargaining units by a majority of the eligible employees voting on the question within each of the units. The results shall be certified on a bargaining unit basis. All public employees in the bargaining unit shall be considered eligible, and all elections within state service, pardon me, within state service shall be conducted by the board. At that point, then we would further support, or I would further support, the addition of the executive department's proposed amendment following that.
Are there any questions of Mr. Springer? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, I
just,
we just had handed out two sets of amendments. One, I guess this is Mr. Springer's read, and then the executive department clip to the back of it. Here's one from Caroline Miller.
She's going to be the next.
She's going to talk about hers. All right. Do these cover the same?
That's Ms. Miller's amendments are a modification, I believe, of the amendments of Mr. Hansel from the executive department the other day.
Okay, thank you.
May I ask?
Yes, Lynn. Go right ahead.
If you had two votes, what do you think the vote would be after the contract, say that after the contract was approved, and two-year contract and all, or 1 year? What do you think the vote would be for fair share after the state employees or any bargaining group received their goodies? Do you think that the majority of the people then would support fair share?
Well, I believe as I have addressed the situation in the proposed amendment, speaking to a bargaining unit basis, bargaining unit meaning the separate bargaining units within the state service, such as the employment division, the highway division, motor vehicles division, those are all independent bargaining units. I do believe a good percentage of those bargaining units would adopt fair share. However, I do believe that some of those bargaining units would not. And I believe it is incumbent upon the bargaining agent or the employee's representative in that area, the certified representative, to show those people that they, in fact, do represent them, can do the best job with them, and for them to lobby amongst their people for the passage of fair share. And I do not believe that the first time around they would get every unit. No, I do not.
All right, let's carry it a little bit further, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead, Robertson.
A bargaining unit, bargaining agent, has to have a certain amount of dollars to operate on, right?
Yeah.
Supposing that no one contributed and you didn't have any bargaining agent, you feel that you'd be better off then than you are?
No, I...
With one? I mean, Who's supposed to pay the cost of all of this?
Well, I'll back
benefited
up.
Benefited employees or just a few of the benefited employees?
I guess I'll have to back up and make a statement I should have said earlier. I am in favor of fair share in its concept. I have served OSCA for many years in different offices and capacities, two of those on its board of directors. I do know what the financial implications are, the hardships of operating a union without everyone paying their fair share, their fair part of the load. However, I do feel that the union has to do something to show the people that they, in fact, are providing. I feel that the employees have to have a way to give voice back to the union. And if this is not supporting them, that's one way of doing that. The bill as written, I believe, would lock fair share in, give the employees no avenue other than decertification of the bargaining agent. This at least leaves within the law the option to decertify or the option to take the fair share back out to give some type of monetary punishment to the organization, if you want to use that term.
Can't you give the same sort of, punishment by participating in your union activities and voting against the leadership in the union? Isn't this just another tool? You're saying, well, we don't have to attend union meetings and participate. We got a bigger hammer out here. Wouldn't that be true?
I appreciate your what you're saying in that area, and I can only speak on an individual to a situation. And that I met with a group of members of this organization last fall over concerns of the organization, and due to that, I was threatened with expulsion of membership because I talked derogatorily about the Oregon State Employees Association to someone other than its board of directors directly. I was told I did not have the right to address anyone except its board of directors in any manner except in a convened meeting of that board of directors. That was furnished to me by certified mail from Jim Kins, the president of that organization, I believe in October of last year, and by order of the board of directors.
What you're saying then is that you can't participate. What you're saying then is you feel that there's a denial of free speech unless you participate in union meeting.
I think the employees need another avenue if that avenue fails.
Okay. That's all I have.
Well, I guess I do have one, too. Looking at this proposed amendment, Mr. Springer, in the last sentence says, all elections within state service shall be conducted by the board. Why would you limit it just to the state service?
The reason I limited it just to state service is because I'm concerned with state service. I don't know the situations in smaller groups. In state service, and I'll have to speak in relation to OSCA, they represent probably 60 or 70 different bargaining units. There's a lot of separation, whereas in the Portland Public Schools, there's probably one bargaining unit. The same in Salem, there's one bargaining unit. In state service, there's numerous bargaining units, and I didn't feel that I was capable of addressing their situation, and I didn't want to make a proposed amendment that was going to embody a burden upon them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Springer.
Thank you.
Carolyn Miller.
Caroline Miller, Cortland Federation of Teachers. I have testified before, so I won't take the committee's time and other people's time. I have passed out an amendment to the amendment submitted by Mr. Hansel, and in the hall I spoke with Bill Wyatt, who presented me with one of his amendments, and we had talked earlier, and I see that my amendment has been incorporated into his amendment, so I will stand by Bill's amendment. There is only one issue in Bill's amendment that we have talked about, and I do want to go on record of expressing some concern. Do you have Bill Wyatt's amendment?
Maybe we better wait a minute until
okay.
Members can get all these amendments in front of us.
Which one is the Wyatt's amendment?
Says they haven't been distributed yet.
Haven't got it yet. Okay.
You guess there's supposed to be the black culture.
Can we
can't you do it? Even a little simple
job.
The
secretary's like gotten a lot bigger and a lot uglier.
Illegal electricity bill.
Power
bill.
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 Bill. Bill.
Sorry about that. I didn't realize you didn't have a copy. I just want to speak to the last sentence, beginning with "this provision shall not apply." What it in fact does is preclude the right to petition for separation of the fair share issue where the collective bargaining agent has a membership of 55% or more. I just want to go on record of having two concerns on this proposal. It strikes me that it tends to discriminate against particular sections of the public employee group. That's the first point. And the second, and I guess it's the one that is the real reason why I'm raising the concern, is that by this kind of potentially discriminating situation, there could be litigation. Two of our locals, Scappoose and Klamath Falls, have requested that if this provision goes through, that we seek a court injunction. I just want to bring that to your attention. I also have talked to John Danielson, and I think he has some interesting arguments in support of this provision, but I do want to indicate that we would be on record opposing that addition. That's all. Thank you.
That's the last
sentence.
Yeah, okay.
Are there any
questions of Carolyn Miller?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Russ Heineman?
My name is Russ Heineman, and I work for the Oregon Employment Division. I'm the president of the OCA chapter at the Employment Division Headquarters Building, and also a member of the OCA negotiating team that deals with the Employment Division and collective bargaining. OCA's policy on fair share is to gain fair share in all bargaining units we represent. That policy was set by the membership through the representatives at OCA's annual General Council in 1972. The reason we seek fair share is obvious. Everyone who is being represented by OCA or by any bargaining agent should pay for that representation. Presently, only members pay. For example, in the Employment Division, we have approximately 60% membership. The 60% pay for the collective bargaining representation, and the remaining 40% get a free ride. With the intention of solving this problem in the Employment Division, we voted a vote in the Employment Division in 1975 to determine whether the members of the bargaining unit wished to have fair share in the collective bargaining agreement. And by a vote of 878 to 476, the employees voted for fair share. Now, this was a resounding victory in terms of, it was a 402 vote margin, but it was only a narrow victory in terms of meeting the legal requirements. At the time of the vote in 1975, there were approximately 1,500 employees in the bargaining unit. So in order to meet the requirements of the law as they exist now, 50% plus one, we needed 751 affirmative votes. So in reality, our margin of victory was 127 votes rather than 402. This is, places an excessive burden on the bargaining agent. I feel the ratification of a contract provision dealing with fair share should be treated the same as ratification of any other contract provision. So to that end, I urge the passage of Senate Bill 474. Thank you.
Mr. Heineman, you said the membership was on a 60%, 40%.
Approximately.
Does that 40% belong to any union at all?
No.
Okay. And some In some cases, there's alternate unions if you can't.
No, and the we're the exclusive bargaining agent. OSA is the exclusive bargaining agent in the Employment Division.
Okay. Question, Chairman. Representative Rogers.
What attempts have you made, or the 60% made, to sell their product to the other 40%?
Extensive efforts. I'm saying now I think we're about 60%. I believe when we voted 2 years ago, we were higher than that. But membership, of course, fluctuates as an optional item up and down depending on satisfaction of a particular member. They can drop out on a whim. We always have continuing membership drives going, but an attitude, I won't say it's a prevailing attitude, but an attitude that I have heard numerous times is, what's the point in paying if I'm going to get the same thing anyway without paying? And I'm sure there are other reasons for not joining OSCA, but that is a significant issue.
2 years ago, your membership was a higher percentage than...
I believe it was somewhat higher. I don't know the exact figures of the membership at that time.
Interesting. You've been trying to increase your membership and instead losing.
Well, like I say, it fluctuates up and down. It depends. There's a high degree of turnover of employees in the association, or employees in the Employment Division. And also, another factor, too, has been that, and I don't know how significant a factor, but there are a larger portion of employees now who are not members of the bargaining unit by virtue of the fact that they have been excluded from being in the bargaining unit. In other words, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 200, whereas 2 years ago, I don't believe it was anywhere near that number. And many of those people have felt that they have dropped out of OSCA because they felt that they shouldn't continue membership when they were considered part of management.
Have any idea what percentage of the dues are actually necessary to the maintenance of the contract as opposed to other activities of the bargaining unit?
I really don't think that I could answer that. I don't have any figures and so on about that sort of thing. I think that can be answered by someone else.
Okay, thank you.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Fred Tollison.
My name is Fred Tollison. I'm from Salem. I'm the chairperson of the Employee Representation Committee for OSCA. Our committee is charged with making policy recommendations on all representation issues, which include collective bargaining, grievance procedures, and so on. Senate Bill 474 is a good bill, and we strongly recommend it. It overcomes some standing inequities. Mr. Heineman talked about the inequity of the election, and I'd like to give you just one more example of that. If you have a 1,000-person bargaining unit, the average voter turnout is somewhere around 60%, which equals 600 voters. If we have to get 501 affirmative votes out of those 600 members, that means we have to turn out 83% in favor of fair share, rather than a simple majority, which the writers of this the original 73 collective bargaining bill intended. I'm sure that's what they intended. The bill also reduces fair share to an article in the contract. We don't vote separately on vacations or grievance procedures or other articles of the contract. We shouldn't vote separately on fair share. It should be an article in the contract that is approved at the same time all other articles are approved. Additionally, fair share is extremely important, but we shouldn't have to write a separate contract for it, which is what it comes down to. We have heard a lot of debate in the newspapers. We've heard a lot of debate among members, and debate inside and outside of the union is very carefully preserved. We are an extremely democratic organization. We believe strongly in the right of individual members to dissent and speak their minds in regard to the issues. And we hope that this debate and differing opinions that you hear in the Labor Committee do not translate that to mean that we lack conviction, for we do not. I believe that the majority of the members, the vast majority of the members, are strongly behind their leadership and strongly in pursuit of their aims and goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman. You referred to the average voter turnout as approximately 60%. Is this in the ratification of the main contract itself?
I'm speaking to the general experience of the organization over the years that I've been acquainted with it. The turnout on the fair share vote at employment in 75 was somewhat higher. If you'll recall, there was imminent strike threat at that time, and the issue was literally white hot. And that tends to turn out a lot of voters. It's the same as in the political process. If you have a lot of white hot issues floating around, you tend to have a higher turnout.
Well, you didn't answer my question. Is that 60% turnout based on the main contract, voting on the main contract itself?
Yes.
The main collective bargaining contract.
Yes.
And the same ratio would hold true for...
Yes, there's approximately 40,000 employees in the state of Oregon, and they vote approximately the same way as the general population.
Even on something as important to them as a collective bargaining contract.
We have to devote a tremendous amount of resources to get the vote up to 75% as it was in the employment division.
Where did they go to do this voting?
They vote in their work unit, they vote in their chapters. We make it as easy for them as we possibly can. Sometimes we hold the polls open 2, 3, 4 days so that everybody has an opportunity to get their vote in. As in my case, I travel quite a bit, and sometimes I'm not there on the first day that the ballots are available, but surely in that period of time I'll have an opportunity to vote. We distribute the ballots through our organizational structure to everybody who is eligible to vote.
And so this voting can actually be done at the place of work?
Yes.
And still that's all percentage that votes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, Al?
Where is the fair share now? I mean, what is it amount to dollar wise?
It's $5. $5, yeah.
And you have 40,000 employees?
No, not in the bargaining unit. There are about 27,000 people that we represent. There are approximately 40,000 state employees, but there are 27,000 that we represent.
That you represent?
Yes.
Al, I'll give you the breakdown. As the gentleman said, there's about 40,000. There are about 29,500 that are eligible for collective bargaining purposes. There are approximately 10 labor organizations that represent employees in the state service. The OSCA represents that 29,500. We're not going to quarrel over 500. Approximately 26,000. They have bargaining rights on approximately 26,500. The remaining 9 labor organizations represent the other 3,000 state employees that are covered by collective bargaining. I think the testimony has been everywhere from the OSCA represents anywhere. Our members have members of, what, 15,000?
Yes.
They have 15,000 members. So that means that they're under just the concept of fair share. There are approximately 11,500 member people who would fall within the ambit of the fair share.
That's $690,000 a year. Additional
group.
No,
that's true.
Okay, thank you.
Get all this information. Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Your testimony indicates that you're in favor of the bill just the way it is.
Got all the figures.
Is that right?
Yes.
Without any of the amendments?
Yes. If Mr. Wyatt testifies that some changes are necessary, we'll back him because he was our representative.
We realize there's real compromising going on, but your personal choice is to have the bill stay the way it was introduced and passed out of the Senate.
Personally, yes. Realistically, we might have to make some compromise.
All right. How do you personally feel about making it exactly the same as in the public sector as it is in the private sector?
Which particular union would you refer to in the private sector?
Well, I mean, make it like it is under the National Labor Relations Act, whereby you can go ahead and have the modified agency shop arrangement, such as is contained in Fair Share, but petition out.
That's fine. Petitioning is...
Well, this you're talking about in the National Labor Relations Act is the union shop petition. We would very gladly accept that petition.
Yeah.
Union shop with the ability to petition out.
We'll take the exact same thing they presented as long as they...
Mr. Wyatt...
I want to get there's a couple bills. There's another bill here that I want to get Mr. Mager up here on. Mr. Danielson, thank you, sir. Mr. Danielson, do you have an amendment to propose?
Mr. Chairman, I submitted the amendment on behalf of the next week.
Okay, as long as the amendments are before the committee, there are a number of them. Okay, you do have the amendments.
Do you want them distributed? I didn't know.
No, hang on to them because the counsel, Anita, will take all the amendments and give us an analysis of if there's any difference in most of them. It appears that there is. Mr. White, you and Mr. Danielson can come back at some other time. The hearing on Senate Force 474 is closed until we have a chance to get all the amendments together to find out exactly what they do. Mr. Mager, why don't you come up here very quickly, sir?
This is 955.
Yes, sir. This is 955, Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Mager. I am vice chairman of the Builders Board. And reference to this bill, while I signed the statement against it, we are not opposed to the legislation. We are only opposed to some of the mechanics of the legislation that the wording create. The wording gives registered builders the opportunity to file an additional registration. This gives us some concern from staff point of view of workload. We do not know what an additional registration will entail, whether that would be simply a memo indicating include me in certain activities or in commercial construction activities, or file an additional registration could mean full bore, new file application, a new bonding, certainly the bonding company would have to be informed and it would have to be investigated as to whether or not the existing bond covered the additional activities. So with that in mind and the workload and the problem of what this might do to the industry, that they might have additional expense of additional bonding, and we would propose a small amendment to the bill relative to section 2 on line 5. We would propose you change it to read, any builder or specialty builder registered under this chapter may, at the time of registration or renewal, at no additional fee, include registration for activities performed by the builder or specialty builder in the construction, alteration, improvement, moving, demolition, and repair of commercial and industrial buildings. This would not change the purpose. It would only make the mechanics of doing it easier, would not create additional workload, and would possibly eliminate some additional expense to the builder if he, in fact, were required to have an additional bond. If that change were accepted, then in line 9, there would need to be a minor change there that the words "an additional" would need to be scratched.
Okay, Mr. Mayor. Representative Otto moves the adoption of the amendments from Legislative Council of 610-77. Bill, it appears that the major substance is that where the present bill says they can file this additional registration at any time, they have restricted it at the time of registration or renewal. All members of the industry have told me that they favor the amendments that Mr. Mager has, and there's no dispute with them. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the amendments are so adopted. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I move A, Gross Senate Bill 955 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The motion is to say A, Gross Senate Bill 955 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
I'd just like to ask why it only applies to commercial industrial buildings. I'm asking anybody.
Go ahead, honey.
Senate Bill 40.
Mr. Honey, why don't you come up here and sit down at the microphone and state your name.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Honey. I represent the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. In answer to your question, Representative, Senate Bill 43 during the last session was passed, and the intent of that bill was to include all construction for the specialty crafts, residential, industrial, and commercial. However, the intent eliminated industrial and commercial, so now this amendment, or this bill here, will encompass the entire spectrum.
Non-commercial industrial has already got this provision.
That's right, sir.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chairperson Twillingoss?
Aye.
Senate Bill Senate Bill 955, as amended, will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Oliver, you're going to carry it.
Mr. Chairman, I would request that it not be put on the unanimous consent calendar.
Okay. It's not going to be put on the unanimous
consent. We've got to listen to you for more than 2 minutes.
I'd like to open up the hearing very quickly. Let me ask this. The people that are signed up, we talked earlier, they've all got their agencies except two listed. Mr. Quackenbush, are you with the Department of Veterans Affairs here in Salem? Mr. Nussbaum, you're with here in Salem? Mr. Carlton? Okay. Mr. George is with Revenue. And Mr. Stevens is with Public Welfare. Now, gentlemen, have you had to take a day off to be here? Are you, in fact, being authorized to be here?
I'm taking part of the days off. I do go from here to work now. I probably take 2 or 2.5 hours.
Okay. Is Liam Gilmore here? You're from Salem here. Who are you with? Public Utility Commissioner. Mr. Thompson? Okay.
What's the bill?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Senate Bill 727. The session is starting right now. Here's the problem I've got. Mr. Wyatt, the bill, as you know, the committee was rather somewhat confused as to what the bill actually did. And instead of having you gentlemen come up and each of you testify, and then we find out at the very end when we call somebody else that's going to explain it all, I thought I'd get Mr. Wyatt, and he has Eleanor Myers, who has a great deal of understanding of this particular program, to come and explain it to us. The only problem is the session's in session right now. It's my intent to put the whole agenda over into Monday
in the same manner, those bills that we didn't handle. And since I put this over twice, it's my intention to put this up at the beginning so that you would not have to come back again. I understand how important it is to you. It's just that we're in that part of the session where there's no certainty that the committee will even be here. From day to day, we had a caucus, and I apologize to you for that.
Mike, there's no chance that we could be excused to have our meeting during the session today?
Well, the problem is that there's going to be another caucus.
Yeah, I understand.
And I don't know what's going to happen. It's just so uncertain right now.
Okay.
Okay. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, we're going to have the dedication of the wings so all the Republicans can revel in the glory of the creature they created.
Does that include the 1% for art, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing none?